From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember composer Burton Lane, who died yesterday at the age of 84. His many songs include Everything I Have Is Yours, How Are Things in Glacamora, I Hear Music, On a Clear Day, and How About You. We'll listen back to a 1990 interview with him. Also, the story of how a group of Tibetan Buddhist monks and nuns recently escaped from Tibet in a treacherous journey across the Himalayas. We'll talk with reporter Jeffrey Fleischman of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who traveled with the monks and nuns as they fled the persecution of the communist Chinese government in Tibet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal advisory panel has unveiled its report on how to keep Social Security solvent. The panelists could not agree after more than 2 years of work. They released three separate proposals, including one that would allow people to privately invest their money rather than pay Social Security taxes. Congressman Newt Gingrich is confident he'll win re-election as Speaker of the House, despite a continuing ethics investigation. He told constituents in Georgia today it will be a historical moment.
Tomorrow, when I'm sworn in, I will be the first Republican Speaker to be sworn in twice in a row in 68 years.
Gingrich returns to Washington later today. He'll speak to fellow GOP lawmakers tonight in a closed-door session. The election for the speakership is tomorrow. Only one GOP lawmaker, Michael Forbes of New York, has announced he won't support Gingrich. Tens of thousands of California residents are still out of their homes. Snowmelt in the Sierra Nevadas has pushed the Sacramento River above its banks. Federal Emergency Management Agency Director James Lee Witt is touring flood-damaged areas today to see what displaced citizens might need.
We're here as a federal team to offer our help and a partnership and just be a good neighbor to them and try to help them get their lives put back together.
Witt spoke to CBS this morning. 27 deaths are blamed on the series of winter storms that have pounded the West in recent days. Meanwhile, crews continue to clear roads in the upper Midwest after a storm moved through the region, dropping up to 2 feet of snow. There are drifts up to 10 feet high, driving is dangerous, and many schools are closed. The Midwest storm hit on Saturday, forcing motorists to stop at motels for shelter. The Irish Republican Army has claimed responsibility for a bomb blast in Belfast today. A policeman suffered minor injuries. The bomb went off outside the city's law courts. From Belfast, Una Smith reports.
A rocket bomb, which was launched from a passing car, was fired at a police base outside the city courts. The Irish Republican Army claimed responsibility for the bomb and announced that it had placed seven more bombs throughout the city. One policeman was injured, but not seriously, and a woman leaving the court collapsed. The other bombs are said to have been placed at the main bus and railway stations and at four hotels throughout the city, putting the city's security forces onto full alert. The Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams, has said that this afternoon's bomb is a regrettable symptom of a situation that must be tackled, meaning that the bomb is a reaction to the current stalled peace process. Amid fears of a backlash from opposing loyalist paramilitary forces, Gary McMichael, the leader of the Ulster Defence Party, which has close ties with loyalist paramilitaries, has said that the loyalist paramilitaries will not retaliate to today's attack. This is Una Smith for National Public Radio in Dublin.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 70 points at 6,613. That's in record territory. The blue chips are up as investors buy shares of technology companies and others likely to benefit from a stronger economy. There are curbs on program trading on the New York Stock Exchange. Federal and state arrest warrants are out for former MGM owner Giancarlo Peretti. Bloomberg's Alexis Christophorus reports.
The Italian financier Giancarlo Peretti has skipped bail and fled the U.S. Peretti was scheduled to be sentenced in Delaware today. He faced as many as 10 years in prison for committing perjury in the case that cost him control of MGM. His lawyer says Peretti is in Italy. That's a violation of his bail. Peretti's extravagance quickly drove MGM to the brink of bankruptcy after he bought it from investor Kirk Kerkorian back in 1990. When the movie studio failed to pay its debts, it was taken over by the French bank Credit Lyonnais. I'm Alexis Christophorus.
The ongoing consolidation of the defense industry produced another merger today. Raytheon is buying the defense operations of Texas Instruments for nearly $3 billion in cash. Both firms are large producers of missiles, radar, and secret electronic systems for the Pentagon. Officials with the Federal Reserve Board seem confident that inflation will remain tame and that the U.S. economy will keep on its path of long-term growth. Federal Reserve Board Governor Lawrence Meyer told reporters he doesn't see a need now for a change in interest rates. He pointed to the low inflation rate and projections that the economy will expand between 2 and 2.5% this coming year. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember the composer Burton Lane. He died yesterday of a stroke. He was 84 and had been one of the last surviving composers of classic American popular song. Burton Lane left us with many great songs, including How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, How Are Things in Glaucomora, and You're My Thrill. Many of his songs were composed for movies, but he wrote some of his best-known melodies for the Broadway shows Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. He collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. I spoke with Burton Lane in 1990 when he was 77. He had just teamed up with singer Michael Feinstein to record the first volume of the Burton Lane songbook. The album opens with a song that Lane wrote with lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane at the piano. We'll hear the verse from that original demo, then segue into the recent recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls a-falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work we never shirk, in a happy land of tinsel and gauze. Because we like applause.
Burton Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I was received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you two names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old, and this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engaged in some trifling, just very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative. Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, I had to take one too.
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to take, my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, Bert, play, and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, I'll do it if you sit alongside of me. So he was sitting facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, is this your son? And he said, yes. And she said, my name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back. And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for a Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remick's music publishing company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remick's, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, Fran Chartow. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
The song that was used for that movie, well, one of the songs that was used for that movie was Everything I Have Is Yours.
That's right.
Beautiful song. And who in the movie sang it?
It was sung by Arthur Jarrett, who was the current big singer, such as Bing Crosby was at that time. He had his own radio show, and he was the one who sang the song. And the song, everybody knows, everything I have is yours, you're part of me. I got a call one day shortly after the song was purchased, and I was asked if I could think of something for Joan Crawford to do in the song, because she was dancing with Clark Gable by the bandstand, and as she danced by, they wanted her to have something to sing. And I thought of a little phrase, da-da-da, da-da-da-da, which she hummed, and that became part of the song. And all the orchestrations that came out at that time, going back 1933, had that little phrase that she hummed in the picture.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show on the bill. Were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs. Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody which had been done by many people in vaudeville called Ailey Ailey. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl. And he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her, which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week. And she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition, and the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening, because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out. And some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years, and in 1941 was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You.
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein. And there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralphie wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus. And it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I did recorded on the record. And I think it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it?
Thank you.
composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You. You know, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Yeah. Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listening, the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, how about you? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Reed. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
We're listening to a 1990 interview with composer Burton Lane, who died yesterday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Burton Lane, the composer of many great songs, including How About You, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, You're My Thrill, and On a Clear Day. He died yesterday at the age of 84. You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Harburg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love, I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, I would, sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. But most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Did this new record with Michael Feinstein bring you out of retirement?
I've never retired.
I wasn't sure about that.
Well, I'm sure. I've never stopped writing. I've always kept writing. And I think it's important. I remember once during the Depression when things were rough, or actually it was a recession in Hollywood, and it was so discouraging to sit down and write because I couldn't get a job. And I remember when I finally did get one, it was very difficult to start the creative juices flowing. And I think it's just like an athlete. You must keep in shape. And so when I've learned that lesson, I've never stopped writing. In fact, on the album, there are a couple of new songs, and I'm very proud of those songs.
Was there a period where you felt that Broadway or musical movies had changed sufficiently so as to kind of leave you out?
No, I don't think so. One of my problems has been finding a lyric writer that I could really team up with. I remember many times I tried to convince Yip Harburg that when you're a team, you grow together, you have a continuity of work together, and I think that's important. All one has to do is look at the careers of Richard Rodgers, who had a long career with Larry Hart, and then when that broke up and Larry died, he had Oscar Hammerstein. And it was after Oscar died that Dick was in the same situation that most of us are in who don't have a team. He wrote with many writers, never really found a mate, so to speak. So that's one of the problems that I personally have, is not having a steady lyric writer.
But you'd like to have one if you could.
Oh, yes, I would, sure.
I should ask you before we wrap up, how did this collaboration between you and Michael Feinstein happen?
Well, it was Michael's idea. He came to me with this idea. We have been friends. Actually, I knew that Michael had worked for Ira Gershwin, but I never had a chance to meet him until there was a memorial service for Ira in New York, and Michael was there, and I met him that day, and we became friends. And when he would come into New York, we'd meet and spend a couple of hours together around a piano. He would sing, I would play. And it was Michael's idea that I join him in an album. And I said, well, Michael, you know, you do so well for yourself when you're playing. Why do you need me? He said, well, this is what I'd like to do. And that's how it happened.
Is this album changing your life in any way?
I think it's on the verge of changing it. I appeared at the Golden Theater on three occasions. Michael had asked me to do this. And the reaction of the audience was so overwhelming that it kind of shook me up. One of the things I realize is that when we write songs that people like, that those songs are making friends for us. And we, as the writers, don't know who these people are until we appear before them. And it was just an amazing experience.
Burton Lane, recorded in 1990. He died yesterday at the age of 84 after a stroke. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Judy Garland.
I like New York in June. How about you? I like a Gershwin tune. How about you? I love a fireside when a storm is due. I like the David Chips moonlight motor trips. How about you? I'm mad about good books, can't get my fill. And Franklin Roosevelt's looks give me a thrill. Holding hands in the...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story of a 14-day journey across the Himalayas, enduring frostbite, snowblindness, hunger, and the threat of being discovered by Chinese soldiers. We talk with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Jeffrey Fleischman. He traveled with a group of Tibetan monks and nuns fleeing persecution by the Chinese government in Tibet. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A group of 15 Tibetans, mostly monks and nuns, recently escaped Tibet by making a treacherous journey that took 14 days, covered 400 miles, and took them through the Himalayas. They endured frostbite, fatigue, and snow blindness while eluding Chinese soldiers. My guest Jeffrey Fleischman made most of the journey with the Tibetans, reporting on it for the Philadelphia Inquirer as part of their recent series on Tibet. China invaded Tibet in 1950 and ever since has tried to eradicate Tibetan religion and culture. Thousands of monks and nuns have been killed and virtually all the monasteries have been destroyed. An estimated 700 Tibetans are now in prison for political offenses. Several of the monks and nuns who recently escaped are former political prisoners. I asked Jeffrey Fleischman to describe their escape route.
The escape route was 400 miles. And it started in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, and it went through Shigatse and then on to Shagar. And most that leg of it was done on the truck. And then the last 90 miles were done on foot. And they went from Shagar down into the heart of the Himalayas, where you could see Mount Everest off to the side. And then it continued further into the Himalayas until they hit the Nangpala Pass, which at the top of that is the border between Nepal and Tibet. And then once they crossed that, they headed for a little town called Chelsea, and then eventually on to Kathmandu, where they were put in a refugee center.
Who is the guide?
The guide has been doing this for probably 4 or 5 years. His name is Dorji, which is equivalent to John in Tibetan, and that's all we used was his first name. And he was very conservative, but he had the look of a warrior. And he immediately, with the Tibetans, his presence was immediately calming to them because he, obviously they were escaping for their lives and there was a lot of fear and tension through most of the trek. And when he was around, he was just a very calming influence. He was about 5'6", 129 pounds, but he could carry 100 pounds on his back going up a steep mountain passes while he was smoking a cigarette. I mean, he was just an amazing character. And when during the trek, especially at night when the Tibetans would grow tired, I noticed that they would walk up to the front of the pack where he was and reach out and hold his hand, almost like they were getting strength off his aura. And then after a few minutes, they would let go and another one would replace them. And it's sort of he was an energy field for them. And they stuck very close to him and listened to everything he said.
What was his motivation? He had made this trek a lot of times and saved, according to your article, about 500 people?
500 people. His motive, I asked him that because I wanted to know what made this man do this and risk his life, not only being captured, but going over these mountain passes all the time back and forth where the conditions were extreme. And he gave me a two-pronged answer. And the first part was, first of all, Tibetans are so honest that when you ask them a question, they just open right up to you. It's amazing. It's so different from being a journalist in the West and interviewing people where there's always sort of somebody hiding something and you're always wondering. The Tibetans just tell you like it is. And I asked him, and he said, well, first of all, that it was a job, and they paid equivalent of about $250 American each one of them to get over. And there were no other jobs for Tibetans really in Tibet as China was squeezing the country. And so this was a way of income for him. But secondly, and most importantly, after spending time with him, his second answer, I think, was the more accurate. And he said, he was a very humble man, and he said, look at me, I don't speak even my language very well. I'm uneducated, and I can't really help the Tibetan cause. But if I get these, and he pointed over to the monks and nuns, if I can get our educated out, who know English, who know Tibetan, who can do something for our cause, then that is what my duty, and that is what I must do to help my people. And after spending time with him, I think that was his real motivation.
How would he deal with it if somebody was lagging behind, or, you know, they were having trouble with their footing on the mountain passes? Would he be sympathetic or just urge them to just keep moving?
He was sympathetic to a point, and the first night we found out only how far sympathy went, and it was There were three monks on the trek who were fairly well-known political dissidents, and he had to get them out. And he cut the size of the trek down to 15 people to get these people out. And this was a fast-moving trek, and he made that known up front, that we have to move, we can't stop. We have to hike 10 and 12 hours a night and rest little and get up and go again. The first night, we had with us a nun who had tried twice to escape, and she had hepatitis. And the time previous to this one, the hepatitis made her turn back. She was very ill. She was really dying. And I don't know why he brought her along this time. I think she begged him. She had a strong will, and she wanted to get out. And she came with her best friend, who was also a nun. And as we left the first night's trek, only about a half an hour into the trek, maybe not even that long, she lagged further and further back, and he knew that
the nun with hepatitis
mm-hmm. lagged further back, and he knew she's never going to make it. We've got 7 days in Tibet ahead of us, and then we have to go over the Nangpala Pass at 18,500 feet. She's not going to do it. So he stopped the trek. He turned back to her. She and her friend kind of came up very slowly, both crying, and he said to her, "You're not going to make it." The friend who had hepatitis. And she just dropped to the ground and said, "Please take me. I can't go back." And then he looked to her friend, and he said to her, "You have to stay with her." And she bowed her head. She was very humble, and she said she had just gotten out of prison. And she said, "Please don't make me stay. I have to go. It's terrible, but I have to go." And her friend who had hepatitis, who was on the ground, grabbed this woman's leg. And it was her desperate attempt to stay with her. The friend who was standing broke that grip and got to the healthy side of the pack. And I remember standing there in the dark, and the starlight was so bright. And I just remember thinking, it was like a pack of animals when it sensed a sick one, and all the healthy ones gathered on one side. And Dorji, who was the guide, bent down to this kind of just silhouette in a shadow, and said, you just heard this crinkle of money, and he handed it to her, and he said, "Try to get to the road if you can in the morning." And then he got closer to her, and he whispered in her ear, and he said, "I promise you within the month I will get you to freedom." And then just as quiet and a moment as that was, he stood up, turned around, and just started marching as fast. And everyone just fell in formation with him. And everyone just looked back from time to time until this woman was just melted into the darkness. And that was the first night. So you knew that he was sympathetic, but the mission was clear, and that was escape and freedom. And there were casualties along the way, like this woman.
Do you know what happened to her?
No, we were still trying to find out what happened to her, but we don't know if she made it out or if she died right there on the plateau.
Before you crossed the border, you were all concerned about being discovered by Chinese guards.
Right.
Chinese military?
Chinese military. We constantly saw during the truck ride convoys of Chinese military passing us all the time, and there were checkpoints all over the place.
Did you all have a cover story in case you were discovered by the Chinese military?
Our cover story was, for the photographer, myself, and the interpreter, was that we had a trekking permit. And so we were allowed to be in that region trekking, because Everest and a lot of places where Westerners go to trek was right where we were. So our story was going to be if we were caught by the Chinese with the Tibetans, that we were just trekking in this area and came across some Tibetans and just thought it'd be fun to hike and tag along with them. Where we could have gotten in trouble if they didn't buy that story and started going through our bags, through our notebooks, all the film that the photographer had, and then if they were to find out that our interpreter, who was an American, spoke Tibetan, our cover would have been blown a little there. But luckily that didn't happen.
What was the worst you came across in the weather and in the climb?
The climb itself, the worst we came across was the last night that we were with them. It was a trek that left The whole day we had spent cramped in a sheep pen with sheep manure just all over the ground, and we had to hide there all day. And the sun was beating down, and that took enough out of everybody. And the Tibetans were playing cards, and some were chanting and praying. And you had this whole sort of camaraderie in this tiny sheep pen about the size of a living room. And then when the sun went down, the temperatures dropped drastically that night. And at about 7 o'clock or 7:30, we took off walking. And Dorji, the guide, said we had to cross 3 rivers that night and then get across a valley and into the mountains before the Chinese. So when the sun came up, we weren't visible to the Chinese. And that was the worst night because the rocks in this terrain would be like large, almost ostrich eggs, and they would stick up all over. So you would walk and you couldn't see that well, and you'd hit a rock and you'd fall over. And most of us had on 25 or 30-pound packs. The altitude being that high would suck the air right out of you. You'd fall over. You'd have to get back up. Sometimes somebody would help one another back up. But Dorji kept it moving and moving. So you were constantly in this state of flux, even when you fell. And you knew that if you fell far behind, you could be lost out here. And you constantly heard the deep-throated sounds of these dogs that were trained by Tibetan farmers. And sometimes they were wild dogs, but they were trained to go to the throat to protect their barley and wheat fields. So you're constantly worried about that. So all these little worries accumulated. And then when the altitude set in on top of that, and then the cold, then it got, I remember I would carry my water bottles to give me a rhythm in walking, and they just both froze solid while the water was moving while I was walking. So it was incredibly cold. And as soon as you'd stop, you'd just immediately become shivering all over the place. And
the people escaping were Tibetan Buddhists. And I'm wondering if you were able to observe anything about how their faith affected them during this period of incredible suffering and tension.
Mm-hmm. Every morning I woke up, it was to a sound of a chanting, this quiet sort of almost lullaby going on over my head in my sleeping bag as this one monk who was in prison and tortured for 6 years. And he just chanted every day, and he was kind of a piece of solace in all of that. And they were all like that. There was one, the old monk, we called him. He was only 57 years old, but compared to everybody else on the trek, he was old. And he just had this bamboo sack, a pack on his back with his ancient scriptures, and he was so worried that if the Chinese touched those scriptures, they would be soiled. And it was his life's mission to get these out to freedom, more so than his life was to get these things to freedom. And their whole belief and system of suffering and accepting suffering, and through other people's suffering to suck out that compassion and sort of move toward your own enlightenment, was constantly prevalent on this trek.
My guest is journalist Jeffrey Fleischman. He reported on the escape of a group of Tibetan monks and nuns for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with reporter Jeffrey Fleischman of the Philadelphia Inquirer. As part of the newspaper's recent series on Tibet, Fleischman, along with an Inquirer photographer and an interpreter, accompanied a group of 15 Tibetans who fled persecution by the Chinese government in Tibet and escaped through the Himalayas. The journalists had to drop out of the final leg of the escape after the photographer suffered severe exhaustion, but they met up with the Tibetans in Nepal. Fleischman told me that perhaps the most treacherous part of the Tibetans' journey was crossing over from Tibet into Nepal.
What the Tibetans faced was the Nangpala Pass that they had to go up to reach that border was 18,500 feet. So the oxygen level was just about cut in half, maybe more than what it would be at elevation where we are now in the United States. And what happened there, as they were going up there, they had already had 2 or 3 days with no water, or no food, and they tried to melt snow up on the pass to try with a little candle to get water, but that didn't work. And they realized they couldn't stay there. They had to move. This path they followed was part of an old ancient caravan route. And so there were they followed this up, and is a pass that tens of thousands of Tibetans have taken to freedom since 1950 when China invaded. And they had actually come across dead bodies of Tibetans who had died the year before and were frozen in the snow, and nomads had taken these bodies and put them in burlap, and this trek actually came upon them. And then when they finally reached the top of the pass, you would think there would be this euphoric thing, oh, we've reached freedom, we've stepped from China into freedom, but there wasn't. There was all this concern about, okay, we left the Chinese police, we left the possibility and the army of being beaten, of being tortured more, of maybe being killed and thrown in the river. That's what they really believed, that if they were caught by the Chinese, that they would never make it to prison. Then they crossed into Nepal, and that apprehension only went down a few notches because they knew they were carrying bribe money for the Nepali police, because the Chinese would pay the Nepali police for every Tibetan they returned, so they had to do an out-bribing them game. So once they hit that, they felt a little relaxation, and they carried these white paper squares with the Buddhist deities on them. And when they did cross the pass, they threw the squares up into the air and let out a little cheer. And then they draped a white scarf around a pole where there were many already faded and tattered and ripped white scarves of already Tibetans who had already gone through there. And then they moved on again. They knew that until they got to that refugee center, they were never safe. But once they hit that center, their eyes just, they knew it. And when they were finally told, you're okay now, it took them about maybe an hour to really believe that. They wondered, well, maybe this guy will turn us in, or maybe the guy running the center is really Chinese. They're constantly living in fear. And after about an hour, they realize, I'm free.
When was the last time you saw the nuns and monks who you trekked with?
It was at the Chelsea Refugee Center. And they would spend their day eating rice or tiny potatoes about the size of ping pong balls. There wasn't much at the center. It was very poor, very rickety. Everyone slept in this one rickety wooden house with no beds. You just slept on the floor and had fires going. But we spent 3.5 days with them there. And they began to take on weight, and they began to lose their frostbitten scabs, and their temperament began to lighten up a little. But then they were concerned, like the monks, their hair had started growing in. So you'd notice changes in them. And then they became more concerned about the families they left behind, because they knew what their families faced once the Chinese discovered they had escaped. I mean, their families faced torture and other things at the expense of their loved ones escaping. And so their hearts went back to Tibet, but they knew that the journey must take them on.
Do you know what any of them are doing now?
I know the goal of many of them was to be, as they say, be in the presence of the Dalai Lama. That was the thing that kept them going, was the Dalai Lama. We must be in his presence. That to them is the pinnacle. And that's what fueled them and kept their muscles moving. And they wanted to, and being in his presence is really being in Dharamsala, India, and close to him. Some of them wanted to learn English. And so they knew that, like Tashi said, he wanted to master his English because he knew that he had to, that politics were the only way to bring change about in his country. And many of them wanted to learn English because they said that is the international language, that is the way to bring change about. We have to communicate, and that's why the Chinese didn't. Although it's a strange conundrum, because the Chinese, for the most part, don't want Tibetans in Tibet. So why won't they let them escape? Why all this rigmarole about stopping these people from going over mountain passes? What we came to find out was that the monks and nuns are the best and the brightest. And I think the Chinese have seen what the Dalai Lama can do on the world stage, commanding attention in Hollywood, Sweden. And these articulate types of people, they don't want out. And they're also scared of, they'll learn the activist and dissident ways and sneak back in and teach others that way. And so so many of them want to work toward improving their country.
There was a shortage of food on the trek. Did you have any more food than the Tibetans did?
Yes, we had brought processed or dried food that we added water to. And so we were okay on the food-wise. We were always concerned about water. But the Tibetans just brought sheepskin pouches of what they call tampa, which is a barley-scented flour, and they roll it into little, almost like cookie dough balls, and they would eat that. And that was their sustenance, as well as yak butter tea. And it's this very bitter tea, and they would drink that. And they were amazed that we were drinking cold water. They kept telling us, don't drink cold water, it's not good for you. They would always drink hot tea. But typical to their nature, the little bit that they had before they ate, they would offer it to us first.
Would you offer them your food?
We would offer food, and we gave some of them socks and some of them gloves. They really were not prepared for the elements. Two of them were in sports jackets to go, and they were in $2 Chinese tennis shoes and pants with no long underwear. And here they are going in sub-zero temperatures and 18,000 foot mountain passes, and they weren't dressed for it. And we went dressed for it, and that quickly became our good for us.
My guest is reporter Jeffrey Fleischman of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Jeffrey Fleischman, who accompanied a group of 15 Tibetans as they fled persecution by the Chinese government in Tibet by escaping through the Himalayas.
Are you betraying any secrets in this article? Will the Chinese military read your article eventually and say, so that's where the secret path is, and so that's how they get around the checkpoints?
See, the thing that we were concerned about mostly in the article was the protecting Dorji, the guide, because he had to go back into Tibet and do this again. We had a long before the Nangpala Pass is a well-known escape route. It's just that how well the Chinese want to man it. Sometimes they man it really well and cut it off. Sometimes they don't man it that well. It's depending on, but always it's a danger, both environmentally and through armed soldiers for the Tibetans. But the biggest concern in putting the story together was Dorji was such a huge, larger-than-life character in this story, that he had to be part of it, but not to the point of identifying him. We weren't going to identify him at all. We were just going to say the guide and not even use his name. And we asked him, we told him to assure him before we left, we're not going to identify you, and we didn't take his picture either. And he said it, and it was almost... maybe it's something that somebody tells you telepathically, but he looked at us and he said, but you can use my name Dorji. And he said that very proud. And it goes back to earlier what I said about this man doing something for his people. And I think he wanted his name attached to that. And Dorji is really like John, so he didn't, in English.
It's a very common name.
Very common name. So he didn't find that to be... And we kept asking him. We had an hour conversation with him about that. But he said, no, you may do that. And so we did.
You were in a very beautiful part of the world, a part of the world that a lot of outdoor enthusiasts save a lot of money to go to. I mean, it's a hobby for a lot of people, adventuring in the Himalayas. Did the beauty strike you while you were trying so hard just to keep moving and to stay alive during all of it?
The beauty was breathtaking. I would opened my notebook. I don't know how many times I must have opened my notebook, sat by a stream or sat somewhere, and looked at those mountains and tried to describe them. And it was almost like describing them was almost as difficult a task as climbing one of them. There were no words fit those just chasms of things just rippling across the sky. And somebody had described Appalachian mountains to me once as being looking like a kicked rug. But these were so much larger, so much just so majestic. It was just amazing. So constantly you would see, as we kind of threaded through there, our band of trekkers and monks and nuns with all this sort of cruelty at that level, just your mind would get taken away from it. And sometimes I would look at these mountains and daydream, and that would take away the pain of the walk. So, oh yeah, it was amazing. And there were so many ironies captured in that, because you would pass, you'd know that there is at Mount Everest, and there are people who are spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 to camp there in north face down, you know, fleece pants, everything for comfort. And here are these little Tibetans in the shadow of this place going across past yaks and wild dogs in sport coats and $2 tennis shoes. And it was such it was so East meets West, and the contradictions abounded.
Is this story setting your life in a different direction?
These were the simplest people doing the most extraordinary thing I had ever witnessed. And they did it never with saying I, or me. Invariably, after every interview that we had done, a monk would tell us about 6 years in a prison, of being tortured, of being beaten every day, of cattle prodded, of being hung upside down, of being so weak that he was wheeled in a wheelbarrow across the prison grounds because he couldn't stand. And then he would say after that interview, but don't concentrate on me. I only suffered little. And that's the gravity of that would come back to you about things. So I think it changed how I look at suffering and just how we should be as human beings toward one another. And that's taken out of the political context of does China have a legal right to Tibet? Is Tibet really an independent country? This is at a human level, and that's what I took away from it.
Well, Jeffrey Fleischman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Jeffrey Fleischman is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His report on the escaping Tibetans was published last month in the Inquirer's Sunday magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. And this is a recording of Tibetan monks chanting.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from The People vs. Larry Flint, a Milos Forman film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.